This week on the show, what went wrong with MySpace? What was Google thinking? And what will retailers do when they realize they don't need the press? Right here on This Week in Media, number 219. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and we are here with some of our usual suspects coming from, is it Emeryville right now, Morgan?
I'm actually down south in L.A. near Tim.
So oh, okay.
I'm down in Hollywood now. Yeah, just made the move.
Oh, very good. Now, what's taking you to Hollywood?
A new opportunity with a company called Score Big, which is kind of like a price line for live event tickets. It's a new venture startup here in Hollywood, and so I'm here.
Nice. Very nice. Is it both sports and other things and music?
Sports, theater, concerts, you name it. So it's very, very cool opportunity. And I'm excited to be here in the land of the stars. So
there's always this thing fun. Like when you're from Northern California, you always go, why would you move down there? And when you're from Southern California, they're like, why would you move up there? And so there's always this curiosity, like what would take you down away from Northern California?
I think my heart is still up in San Francisco, though. So,
also coming in from Connecticut, Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
Hi. How are you?
Are Alex? You in? Is that where you are today?
I am in Connecticut, in my home office. Very comfortable, actually. So, yeah, we're just surviving an ice storm now. So,
but you still have bandwidth.
I have bandwidth until the power goes out.
So right.
Hopefully, hopefully the ice won't collect anywhere.
Yeah. Very good. So we've got a lot of news to come up. So we have first of all, there's a great article by Amber MacArthur, one of my friends, at theglobalandmail.com, talking about one of the things that she noticed about MySpace, and really the question was what did MySpace, where did it go wrong? It's laying off half of its employees soon, or it's in the process of it right now. And, at one point in time, they were the leader. I mean, they were leading Facebook, but they have over the last couple of years, fallen woefully behind. And now it looks like they're up for the block. It looks like Fox is probably not going to get, or Murdoch is not going to get his money back for this. Morgan, where do you think that MySpace went wrong?
I think it went wrong in two places, really. I think the first is product. They did not innovate, and I think Amber talks about that in her article. And I agree, they kind of sat on their laurels when they had the market share and didn't really push to innovate. And I think the second was really spammy advertising tactics and just kind of being overrun by people looking to take advantage of a large audience. And so the user experience really, really tanked, and people, it was kind of a flight to quality, really. People were looking for a better experience, and MySpace had an opportunity to provide it, failed, and so people looked elsewhere.
I mean, I think that one of the challenges always when you have something that's working, so something that's growing, you're always afraid to change anything because you're afraid that you're sometimes not sure exactly what it is that's working. So, that as lots of people were using it, I think there was probably some intrepidation related to, do we change something that's actually continuing to grow? And then, of course, a lot of times you miss that curve where you're already losing them by the time you realize that whatever that is, that wasn't the problem or that wasn't the thing to save. Alon, what could they have done to compete effectively with Facebook?
I think they lost me when Facebook implemented the newsfeed. And for me, that was a significant thing, because one of my biggest frustrations with MySpace when I was playing around with it was that the newsfeed didn't exist. You never knew what your friends were doing unless you went through each of them individually, trying to, almost like doing bookmarks to kind of click through everybody. And Facebook just killed them, I think, right there. I mean, that I think was the real turning point for Facebook's meteoric rise to success, and MySpace just kind of crapping out. And their new logo is just kind of bizarre too. The one thing that struck me, that I logged on to MySpace today as well, Amber's article kind of inspired me to go do that, because I haven't been there forever.
Amber probably did more in this article to bring people back to MySpace for at least a day.
Absolutely. It's like retro. Everybody's like, hey, remember MySpace? And when I went in there, the first thing you see on the login screen is a Facebook Connect button. So if you can't beat them, join them, right? Yeah. But that to me is probably the most telling thing. And their site's looking a lot more like a content hub. They're sticking to, you know, it's still a good place for musicians to go. And I think they're looking maybe to go more into the content space and be competitive with AOL and Yahoo. It seems to be working for them.
We should have brought my daughter on to the show today because she was a ardent MySpace user. And I remember a while ago, she, you know, I was asking her about MySpace. This is probably a year and a half ago. I asked her about MySpace versus Facebook. And she goes, well, if I want to interact with my friends, I'm on MySpace. If I want to interact with adults, you know, my life, then I post stuff on Facebook. And so to her, like, it was like two different worlds, and she was quite happy with that. And then I talked to her when we were talking about this a couple weeks ago, and she's like, oh, I don't really use MySpace anymore. She had just slowly moved over to Facebook, and then that had become her thing. And I think the news feed, I think it's a much cleaner interface. I think that Apple, you know, pays a lot of attention, probably too much attention sometimes to the user experience to the point where nothing, you know, things don't move very quickly. But at the same time, I could never go up to MySpace and be there for very long without just going crazy. You know, the layout, the way it was organized just made me insane, you know, like almost literally insane.
You sure it wasn't the flashing backgrounds, Alex?
Yeah, I was going to say there's a lot of blinking on there.
It was just all the things that you could do with it, and it was all the wrong things. You know, you know, it's just not things that you wanted people to do. That's all. So the it was, you know, it's very interesting to see, you know, how this goes. I think that this is a danger for anyone, though. I mean, this is also the issue when you get into the tie-in with Facebook. You know, before this, we had Friendster, we had MySpace, Vox was a blogging tool that people were using. And the big danger, of course, is always that as easy as it is to grow to, you know, millions or tens of millions of people, it's also just as easy for them to go away. You know, how do we create I have a question for Morgan. How do we, or in both of you, really, how do we create stickiness, or how does someone create stickiness so that as you build these audiences, they don't just simply go to the new fad or the new trend right after, you know, as it's moving forward?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that's one that Facebook is going to be facing too. And I think, you know, especially with folks that are kind of in the early adopter phase, there is some frustration maybe with Facebook, or some, you know, lack of fulfillment with it. And that's why people kind of run around to these different sites like Quora, and, you know, Hipster just announced they got 10,000 signups in, you know, a week and a half without telling anyone what they do. People are kind of looking for the next thing. And I think, these big sites have to continue to innovate. Lon made a great point about the news feed and that being a feature that really provides a lot of value to him. I think Facebook has to keep pushing the envelope, looking for ways to, you know, become, you know, imperative for the online experience for a user. So whether it's Facebook Connect, whether it's where you find out where your friends are, whether it's the news feed, whether it's being your online address book, whatever the evolution is, becoming kind of an imperative to the online experience is really how you create that stickiness, I think, and they have their work cut out for them.
Well, and Lon, what could somebody compete with Facebook, and what would they need to do that?
You know, that's if I knew that, I would be extremely wealthy. And maybe I should think of something. Who would have thought in 1999 that Yahoo would be second fiddle to Google, right? I think it's one of these things where once the stickiness does occur is when it really does take off. Apple's finding that, you know, if your friends are not on Ping and using Ping, you're not going to use Ping either. In some cases, like Orkut, they became immensely popular in a few countries, not in the United States, but right. Was it Brazil and Iran, I think, were the two big Orkut countries. So I think that's why Facebook continually rejiggers everything on their site to keep it fresh, to keep introducing features that people want to use, and to keep doing things that keep them, you know, attached to it. I did find it funny that they're trying to make life a little bit more difficult for Zynga, which is probably the most sticky thing that Facebook has ever seen, with all those addictive little games. Not that I'm addicted to any of them that go on there. But I think that's the fear that all of these companies have, and the fact that Facebook became much more Twitter-like when Twitter's user count started to rise is a good example of just how perhaps how paranoid they are, and rightfully so, that they could be yesterday's news in a month.
Well, and I know for me, I still don't, and I think this is some kind of generational gap. That I don't use Facebook that much myself. I have a Facebook account. I have lots of friends on it. But I have to admit that my primary way of interacting with everyone is Twitter, and I just have it piped, you know, into Facebook. So people see it on my Facebook page. But I'm not actually going to Facebook very often. I would say it's because it's on the web, and I don't really like dealing with the web that much. I mean, I just get frustrated with it. But I Twitter most of the time from the Twitter client, I mean, from Twitter on the web. It's kind of how I think about it. But I think that there's something about, and it seems like a lot of people in their 35 to 50, they're much more likely to be on Twitter once they understand what it is. I mean, I think most people with all of this stuff, it's like, well, I think Facebook's easier to understand than Twitter. Like, most people I talk to are not on Twitter, are just don't understand why, you know, they don't understand what there is for them in Twitter until you start doing it, and then you get kind of connected to it in the same way, I think. But I think in Facebook, everyone kind of feels this draw that you have to do it because all your friends are doing it. You know, that seems to be a group mentality, don't you think?
Yeah, and you know, I look at how I use all these tools. I love both, and I find Facebook is where I communicate with my non-techie friends, right? People in town, you know, that. And I've actually now made my Facebook only people who I know have some connection to. Twitter has become my techie place and the place where I talk about, you know, technology. And I have another account that I kind of spout off on Connecticut issues of the day that links up with a lot of members of the press here. So Twitter's been a great tool for that. So I think there's distinct uses there. And one thing that I think Twitter's done very well is that they let the users and the developers design Twitter the way they wanted. So perhaps they've inoculated themselves against some of these things where if Facebook had a certain feature that caused people to leave MySpace, Twitter users can just implement it themselves if they have the ability to do so. And we've seen a lot of that user-driven terminology work its way into the Twitter system. Retweeting is a great example of that as a way of and the at reply, for that matter, too, has really worked its way into that. And it's an interesting model that it's almost the closed versus open approach that we see with Google versus Apple.
Yeah, and I think that with Twitter, I find that I am – it is interesting that there's so many different ways to interact with that data. You know, as far as like, you know, you have the core, your followers and what you're doing, but you have, you know, TweetDeck and you have the Twitter client, which was what used to be Tweety, which, by the way, have you seen the client on the Mac?
I'm using it right now.
Oh, my gosh.
It's awesome.
So am I. I love it, too.
It is so Mac-like. I mean, you know, it's so like GUI and works, and it's just an incredible implementation of Twitter. If you haven't seen it, I think this is something that did they release this with the Mac App Store?
Yeah, this was the upgrade. There was one called the Tweety for Mac was didn't support all the new Twitter features, but Twitter 2.0, which is technically Tweety 2.0, is in the Mac App Store exclusively.
Yeah, it's very, very, very interesting. So anyway, we'll see how this goes. We'll see if anybody else can crack the code of gathering people together. And what's interesting is it's, while it's competitive, I think that it's not as competitive in some ways because a lot of us have accounts in all of them. I mean, a lot of times, you know, I have a LinkedIn account, I have a Facebook account, I have a Twitter account. I think that's pretty much, those are my main accounts that I'm using. And then I have my Pixelcore membership because it's, you know, my thing. but that one's like the small number of people that I work with most of the time. And then I have LinkedIn, which is kind of my greater professional connections. And then Facebook is kind of, I don't know, I don't even know how to define who I'm connected to in Facebook. And then Twitter is just anybody who wants to listen to me spout off about very, very random things. So I know where I'm posting, and when I'm posting different places, I really think about those. I don't really post that often in, for instance, LinkedIn, because those are a lot of people that in my greater professional world are there. It's not like I'm going to talk about the kids, you know, on my LinkedIn account. So I think a lot of us also kind of silo a lot of this information. Also in the news, Google is dropping, this was big in the news last week, Google is dropping H.264 from the Chrome. And people are, you know, saying that it's a step backwards. Google says that it's a step towards openness. Lon, which side do you think they're really falling on?
You know, I think this continues that battle of closed versus open, because, as you know, Google has acquired an open source video codec. Was that VP8? Is that the codec, Alex?
Well, they made it open source. So they bought on two. So on two, made the VP, you know, there was the VP6, which a lot of it has was, you know, brutalizing us for a long time in the Flash codec, which is a horrible format. And then VP8 was supposed to be a lot better. It's better. It's a little bit more computationally expensive than H.264, in my opinion. But then they bought it, and then they made it open source. And now they're saying that this mWeb is all that they're going to allow to use. And they're getting support from Firefox and also Opera, I believe. So that's what they're going to support officially for that video. But again, back to you, Lon. Do you think that there is this really a move towards openness?
I don't think so. I mean, when you give people less choice, it's hard to be open. but, you know, I can see why they're doing it, of course, because H.264 is essentially closed in the sense that there's a licensing fee involved with using it for production or for distribution. All of our cameras have a license that limits us to some degree or another, which they're not yet enforcing. But there is that potential for that to occur as well. In looking at this story, I was trying to see how many of the sites I visit actually use that video tag. I would imagine on my iPad there's a lot more of that because the iPad obviously is using HTML5 for embedded video. On my web browser, even blip.tv, which is what we use at localonlinenews.tv for our video hosting, is H.264, but it has a Flash wrapper. And they're doing that, of course, because they have advertising injection and all that kind of stuff. So I think for the average user who's on a desktop computer, it's not going to matter as much. And, of course, Chrome actually has its own Flash plugin that they bundle with Chrome on, I think, almost all the platforms that they serve.
They're talking about open standards, but they're still supporting mm-hmm. Flash, right? Which is not an open standard.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of ironic too. So you know, I would imagine that someone will create a plugin to bridge these things. But it's just bizarre that we're in the age that we are, where we're finally getting rid of the plastic, right? No more tape, no more DVD or Blu-ray or HD DVD, and we're still having format wars. And I don't think they will ever go away.
Now, and one of the issues here, of course, is that this is really it comes back to a cost. You know, where Google could pay up to $6.5 million a year through either Google or usage, especially as you're starting to go through video codecs, also through YouTube as you make things commercial, as you start to have paywalls, as you do any of these things, this starts to flip on some of the H.264 cost structures, because they've really designed it as something that if you're a small producer or individual, you're not going to pay royalties against H.264. But if you're a big company that's doing video, which would include Google, you may end up in a situation where you are incurring, again, up to $6.5 million of royalty issues that you have to deal with every year to pay for all of this. So the thing is, here's the question, Morgan, is Google really looking for an open internet, or is it looking for a free internet specifically as it relates to them?
I think it's definitely the latter. And, you know, it's unfortunate because I think if you look at the profile of like a Chrome user and the profile of an iPad user, I would imagine you have a pretty decent overlap there. And so it pits kind of the user, you know, you're picking sides depending on where you're going. And I think that, you know, it felt like for the last year and a half or so, we were kind of all rowing in the same direction. You know, Microsoft with IE9 came on board. They said they were going to be standards compliant. We started to have some, you know, coalescence around these standards. And this feels like a step backwards and a kind of a short-sighted one from Google and them open sourcing this kind of privately developed video codec that, you know, it hasn't been put through the patent process in terms of vetting it for kind of stepping on other patents and that type of thing.
Well, and this is a big question, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the issues is that no one knows. So if you start adopting the WebM format, you don't know whether this is actually going to hold up. So you could build an entire infrastructure around something that, because you know that, especially now that Google has kind of fired this shot across the bow, the H.264, you know, the MPEG, you know, consortium is definitely going to take aim at making sure that none of their patents are being touched at all. And they're going to tie this up in court if they have to. So isn't this, is this is shaky ground.
Very shaky.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's very risky for I think anyone at this point to adopt that as their main, except for Google, who's got pockets to defend it. And they've got a lot to gain. But for smaller commercial content providers, it's dangerous to do that, because we've seen in past lawsuits when we had that whole SEO with the Linux issue, where they were going after people who were distributing Linux distributions and people who were using Linux distributions for patent infringement claims. So there's a lot of risk here, and it seems like Google is trying to create a competitive format. But for me, I certainly would just kind of keep things the way they are and know where I'm safe, which is with my H.264.
Do you think that they were caught a little bit, if they wanted to make this a standard, they were almost caught, it seems to me, that they might have almost been caught between a rock and a hard place. If they let H.264, if they go any further, I'm sure that they wanted to become bigger and more of a standard before they try to impose some kind of pressure like this. But at the same time, if they wait any longer, H.264 becomes the de facto standard, which it almost is at this point. So was it a situation where if they were going to make this play, they were really running out of time to do it?
I think so. I mean, H.264 is almost ubiquitous now, right? It's just about everything is using it. And I think they probably looked at that saying, you know, not only do they have to pay royalties for hosting the video, all of those Google phones have some kind of royalty attached to it. They're getting much stronger into the tablet space as well. So they're dealing with that as well. And Apple gets some return on that investment because they're part of the H.264 and the MPEG-4 LA. I think they're part of that patent group. They pay into it. Yep.
And they get money back out of it.
Right. They get money out. And Google's not at the table. And I think that's probably what they're shooting for. And, you know, open is open, but open can also compete against closed. And I think that's really the philosophical fight going on. And unfortunately, a lot of us users are going to bear the brunt of it.
Very, very interesting. Now, speaking of video, one of the things that's happening is now that we're looking at 4G LTE and WiMAX and all these things that are starting to roll out, we're starting to see big bumps in bandwidth. So people are now, they're not technically, I feel like I'm being really particular about this, but none of the networks that we're seeing are really 4G. So we should all keep that in mind, because 4G is 100 megabits a second, which we're not going to see from anyone anytime soon. But 4G seems like it's a good thing to say. But it is a big increase of average speed for most people. And along with this is coming a lot more video, a lot more visual applications, a lot more video conferencing, so on and so forth, because now suddenly all these portable devices are really being empowered with the kind of bandwidth that they need to really create a great experience from that. Morgan, do you think that this is going to usher in a whole new revolution of video production for the web or for mobile?
Yeah, I think it's. I think it definitely has the promise for it. I think it's going to have to be backed up by the networks themselves. You know, I'm sitting in Hollywood and I have zero bars on my iPhone 4 here, so regardless of the network outside. But I do think, you know, I think early adopters are willing to put up with a degraded user experience. So whether it's waiting for a video to buffer longer, whether it's, you know, dealing with some chunkiness, we put up with it to be able to work with what's available. But I think the mainstream, for example, my mom has an iPhone 4. She doesn't really like the video because she doesn't like waiting. And I think as the technology, the bandwidth improves, more people like her will turn to their phone for that type of content. And I think it will do all sorts of things for content production, content providers, all sorts of people in that ecosystem delivering to these devices.
And Lon, do you think this changes the online strategy for a lot of, as video becomes this pressure, an online strategy for a lot of not only sites, but a lot of the, you know, retailers and so on and so forth who want to get to people? Does this put more pressure on incorporating video with what they're doing?
Oh, definitely, and I can think of a multitude of things. Real estate, just off the top of my head, you know, you're walking by a house and you want to get some information on it. You know, being able to kind of watch a tour from wherever you are, getting that information and being able to watch something quickly where you're at is really critical. And faster, I agree with Brady with Morgan. You know, the faster startup time is really critical, and the resolution is also pretty critical also, especially for selling products. You know, right now, if you try to look at YouTube over AT&T 3G, they just make it look like mud. So getting that you know, getting that faster startup, better resolution, I think it'll only benefit everyone, and it's good for content creators like us, because there's going to be a lot of people who need help getting those videos produced.
Well, and it seems like something that's very location based. Now, Morgan, you formerly from Turn Here, this is, you know, getting this tied in so that you could watch those little videos as you were in that area quickly and easily would make a big difference for the retailers who have become part of that network, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, if you're, you know, and it kind of ties into this whole augmented reality too. If you're in the middle of a main street somewhere you've never been before, or if you're looking at a map, you can see the street, you can see the storefronts, you know, with Google Street View, but you can't go in the stores. You know, delivering video real time to a device of the inside of that store or the inside of that restaurant or, you know, the house, as Lon said, will really change the way we kind of look for things and make our decisions, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. Also, this is for you guys. This connected to this is publishing without publishers. So this is from David Carr's article in New York Times, talking about how a lot of these luxury brands have gone from essentially being, you know, trying to get into magazines and into these things. They're now starting to look at, you know, we could just make our own content. Now, a lot of these are making their own websites. They're making their own front ends. And it does seem like this may be a trajectory that is going to continue to grow. Morgan, do you think that people are, that more and more companies are going to simply try to be the press rather than get press?
I do. I think there's really a line being blurred between what is editorial content and what is promotional content. And I think we see it with companies like even the demand medias that are cranking out kind of informational articles, but are clearly, you know, profit driven. And I think we'll see more and more of that as companies look for ways to engage with their customers, whether it's branded video content on Facebook, kind of behind the scenes series, whether it's informational articles and that type of thing. I do think that this idea of brand as a media company is just going to become more and more prominent, and it's going to get harder to figure out. You know, it's like everything that's old is new again. We're going back to the branded kind of sponsored soap operas, but in online video form. And so I think we'll see that continue to become a bigger trend.
Lon, can that be legitimate? Can you, for instance, I remember someone asking me, a friend of mine was doing some work for The Gap, and they asked me, what would you do, you know, to you know, promote The Gap or to do stuff if you were thinking about video and so on and so forth? And my initial response was, I would create shows about fashion. You know, I wouldn't create shows about The Gap. I mean, what I would do is use The Gap clothes as a context. So I would never talk about them, never recommend them, never do anything. You know, it's from The Gap. So it's going to be all content that includes The Gap. But you don't have to talk about it at that point. So we get that out of the way, and we just talk about matching colors. You know, because, you know, guys don't have any idea how to match color. So according to my wife, you know, at least I don't. I've generalized this to all men, you know, to protect myself. So the idea is that talking about whatever the latest spring fashion is for guys or women or whatever, and talking about colors and talking about collar lengths and whether it's buttoned and how the best way to do ties and the best way to, you know, how to combine clothing. Now, of course, that could be all content. And if it was done well and it was good content, I don't have a problem with The Gap doing it. But of course, once you get into comparing it or reviewing, then of course you're going to have, you know, that's when this integrity starts to break up. Lon, is this something that is, can it be viable? Will they get people that actually believe in the kind of content that they're seeing?
Yeah. And in fact, we're doing it. One of the things that we've found over the last year is that more of our revenue is coming from doing these kinds of productions for commercial entities. Now, we actually went through a pretty good discussion as to how to implement this, because what we're doing is for some people in the community wanted their own network. They wanted to have their own video show, and they liked what we were doing with the news. The partners really had to sit down and try to figure out, how do we do this ethically? Now, granted, we're not the New York Times or some huge production or some huge news organization, but nonetheless, there's standards that need to follow. And what we decided to do was kind of fork things a little bit, in that we have a division, so to speak, that is dealing with commercial production. And some of these commercials, quote unquote, are really news packages. We did one for in West Hartford, Connecticut, for Blueback Square, which is a shopping and dining destination. It's a great place. And we found a a spokesperson to kind of be the reporter. And we're doing those productions for them. And people are watching them because they want to know what's going on at this place where everybody hangs out. So it was a really good thing. It was great for them too, because they've been working very hard at trying to get placement in newspapers and on TV. But that whole scarcity of the bandwidth, the cost that it used to take to get a mass message out has completely gone away. Our hosting costs annually are $170 a year right now, and we're using Blip. We're having to give up a little bit of ownership, perhaps, of some of the advertising and whatnot. But that's all it costs. And 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you needed a license from the FCC and all this, and a tower and an engineer and all this other stuff. So I think it's become a lot easier to do that. And I think we'll see more of that. I do think, though, there's still a very important role to play for journalism and having destinations that are doing those investigative things, but something like a shopping show or something that doesn't require the same amount of scrutiny that perhaps covering government is important to maintain. One last point: Gary Vaynerchuk did a video on this a couple of years ago. If you search for like Gary Vaynerchuk ROI for return on investment, he did a great 8-minute thing on exactly this point, and it was a large inspiration for me to get my little thing off the ground, and I think it's something everyone should watch, because that's really where it's going. We're actually seeing a couple organizations here in Connecticut actually hiring investigative journalists to cover issues that are important for their organizations.
Well, and I think that one of the things that's interesting is that when I look at someone's ad campaign, they can spend $250,000 on an ad. That's not to place the ad. That's just to make the ad. And you look at the number of shows that they could produce. I mean, they could produce a year of weekly shows about something, not very high end, like little 3-minute shows or 2-minute things about things for the same price, with lots of little bits about things. And you can do them in batches. Maybe 25, let's say 25 shows, 25 to 50 shows, able to be thrown together for the same price. And the question that I always get into, and this is a question for you, Morgan, is, does it make sense for possibly a lot of these retailers to make their own content and then use their advertising, their mass market advertising, not to so much advertise their goods, but to advertise their content, to use that mass market to pull people towards, their little world where they're going to hang on to those people in a much more sticky environment?
Right. Yeah, I think it really comes down to, if Tim was here, he'd say it's all about the quality, So I think if these brands are making quality content that you want to watch, and like you said, it is sticky, then leveraging traditional media to drive folks to websites, to video portals, and that type of thing makes a ton of sense. At Turn Here, one of their clients, Intercontinental Hotels, did exactly that. They took kind of the traditional budget for a TV ad and instead made 3-minute clips of all of their concierges at 162 properties around the world, showing them kind of the ins and outs of their cities and where the best places to eat and find entertainment, shop, that type of thing. And then they used advertising, web advertising, to drive folks to that portal. And it was, they continue to expand that program. So I definitely think there's some innovative brands out there that are experimenting and finding success with it.
I've seen some of that, actually. I was in an Intercontinental and they play it in the hotel. Like when you that first channel you get when you turn the TV on.
Right.
And it's great. It's great. You get this kind of sense of where you are. Now, I was in San Francisco, so I didn't agree with a lot of the choices. It was just kind of like, really? But when I was somewhere else, I was like, oh, this is great. And that's always the danger with content anything we know, we're kind of like, well, this isn't that accurate. And then anything that we did a bunch of these videos for Travel Channel and for On Networks, and so it is difficult to find the right grouping of videos to put together. But yeah, I think it's a very interesting crossroads there. Now, speaking of TV networks, the TV networks are a little twisted about a new Comcast app. So this is a new an app that Comcast put out for the Xfinity TV app, and this is from techland.time.com. Basically what they did is they created a new app that lets you, it looks like it actually, and I don't have it yet. I have Xfinity, I just haven't put it on, but actually lets you stream and watch stuff on your iPad. And a bunch of TV networks are kind of, calling, throwing the yellow flag down or giving them the red card. And saying that's foul because it's now going on to another one. Now, I think Comcast's argument, of course, is that, well, it's, you know, still streaming. It's still streaming through our network. It's still streaming, you know, just to another screen. But this isn't the way these TV networks are seeing it. Morgan, do you think that the people can, do you think that they're going to figure this out, or are they going to have to pull that app back?
This specific app, I'm not sure. And, you know, and Comcast obviously carries a ton of clout. But I think this really raises an interesting question and kind of gets at the complexities that we have to kind of fight through to get to where we can watch whatever we want, wherever we want to, wherever we want to watch it. And I think there's a bunch of deals that have to be, you know, gone back and redone. You know, if you look at the NBC deal that they did with the NFL to allow Sunday Night Football to be streamed, you know, we need more of those types of deals where it's explicitly spelled out where the stuff can be used so that there isn't this problem, because it's the customer again, it's the end user that gets kind of caught in the crosshairs here. And I mean, I hope the app doesn't get pulled, but it does point to a more systemic problem that these companies have to go back and address with the content creators.
Well, and the companies are saying, you know, this is proprietary information. We gave you a license to use it in cable. You know, Comcast is, of course, saying, yeah, we're paying for it. We're still paying for the programming. They're still paying for that content. I mean, this is not going out to people who, you know, you're not streaming it if you're not already an Xfinity user. So they're, you know, Comcast's argument is, of course, is that they are paying for it. The issue, of course, is that as you start to pull this down, especially now that Comcast is about to own content, it already owns a bunch of content, but it's about to own a lot. Over time, does this become something? Is this maybe one of the reasons that Comcast has been so interested in some of the mergers it's done lately, Lon?
I think so, because they're spending a lot of money not only with cable networks that they don't own, those per subscriber fees that often result in these battles between Comcast and their local network affiliates, as we've seen in, you know, New York and other states over the last couple of years. And I could see why the networks are doing this, because they're saying, hey, you know, we don't stream on our own website. Your license extends to things that are delivered in this manner. I'm sure no one anticipated in their contract negotiation that this app would come from Comcast. So there's certainly that potential out there, and I think it really eats into Comcast's profit margin because they do have to continually absorb these raising per subscriber fees. There's often issues where they have to present those networks to people, even in the most basic cable tiers, which are often the regulated spaces of cable television charges. So there's a lot of pressure on them here, and I could see, you know, that being the case, and they've got a lot to work out. But I think the app will probably stay on. This might turn into something like Google TV has turned into, that it can stream some stuff, but the stuff you really want isn't going
to
be there.
Well, the thing is that figuring out or trying to find some way to make this work in the advantage of the broadcasters, because right now, if you've got a Slingbox, you can do it without anybody's anybody's input at all. Isn't it better for the broadcasters to find some way to work with Comcast rather than just leaving this gaping hole open in the other end? Morgan?
I think it is, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, you look at, they're looking at trading broadcast dollars for internet nickels, and I'm sure that makes them a little nervous. But I do think that instead of having to run around playing whack-a-mole, trying to figure out where this stuff is going to pop up and, you know, having people work around them, it's better to work with them, I think. And we're starting to see that happen. I think Roku just announced that they have their first cable channel signed up with their service. So hopefully we'll see more and more progress. But I do think it's in the best interest of the broadcasters, even if they hate to acknowledge that they're going to be trading big bucks for smaller bucks.
Yeah, it's hard to see how. I mean, it just seems like the market is going to continue to become more diffuse and harder for all these broadcasters, especially the ones that are the most vertical, the most expensive, to survive in the kind of this ever-changing platform. It seems like almost all of them have to go the direction NBC is going, which is become absorbed by somebody else, because that model doesn't seem to really work, you know, anymore. But we'll see. Maybe, you know, they might be able to find some way out. Hey, Morgan, where can people find you?
So they can find me on my blog at pmorganbrown.com, and also on Twitter at Morgan B is my handle there. And they can check out ScoreBig at scorebig.com.
Thanks. And Lon, where can people find you?
You can find me on the Twitter, LonSeidman, and we're having a great conference for independent media producers in Connecticut on January 29th. So if you're interested in attending that conference we're putting together, it's totally free. Hit me up and we'll get you an invite.
And a quick reminder, next week we'll be broadcasting a lot of stuff from Macworld. We are actually going to be doing a lot of 3D tests, stereo tests. So go out and get those red blue glasses, you know, even if they're paper, just to have some around. The only way we can stream to the web is red blue at the moment, because that's what everybody has. If you are interested, do that. We're going to probably post later this week. We're going to post some actual 3D video tests to YouTube as I begin to do that. You can find that at Alex Lindsay PXC. And next week, you'll be able to find a lot of the streams at pixelcore.com/live. So definitely check that out. Until then, this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.